accession number 9081, rule number 3.
Mr. Barthorpe, rule 3.
I'll go back to the day previous to meeting the Norwegian officers. We were going through the wood, it was 3 o'clock in the morning. We were hoping, we'd heard that there was a German advance guard between us and Handel's Ness. And we were going through the wood, it was 3 o'clock in the morning when we were hoping to get through beyond the German lines before they woke up. But as we were strolling through the woods, someone said, "Where are you going?" And we looked round, and there was a group about 90 in the woods. There were 6 officers there. So we said, "We're going to try and get through German's advance guard to get through to Handel's Ness." So he said, "What do you think we're waiting here for?" So we said, "Well, don't you think we stand a better chance, 5 of us and 90 men?" So he said, "Look, if we let you go, you get caught. You're going to bugger it up for us." So he said, "Just stay here, go when we go." And they kept us under the trees while 9 o'clock at night. And we'd walked, so we set off and we'd walked about 5 miles roughly. We got to the foot of a hill and he said, "According to the information I've got, we're now beyond where the Germans should be." And we was at the foot of a mountain road, and they were walking up the mountain road. It was downhill one side and mountain on the other. Going up this mountain road, at the top of the hill we could just see one sentry. He was in front of the hedge. There was a sentry on the roadside, the hedge, what I thought was a school. I don't know what it was, but I thought it was a school. The sentry stood on the road. Now, us 5, we stood at the back because we thought, well, we stand no chance with a group like this. We drop off first opportunity we get. Goes walking up the hill, and everybody was walking casually because they said we was in front of the Germans. They said that was a Norwegian sentry stood out there in front of this building. And this sentry, it was moonlight night. You know, it was dark, but it was moonlight. He let everybody walk past him until he saw us 5 at the rear. Now, he was a German, and nobody caught on because the uniform, in the dark, you couldn't tell anyway. And they really thought he was a Norwegian sentry. And everybody walked past us 5 at the rear. As soon as he saw us, he shouts, "Englander." He was looking for guards. He thought we were prisoners of war. He was looking for Germans behind us. And he just let them walk past. And he shouts, "Englander." And there's machine guns, rifles out every damn window, you know. And there was, it was downhill, you know, mountain, both ways. Well, lads was running all directions. I think there were 15 rifles between the lot of them. But never got a chance to use them because we were being machine gunned. And we'd no cover at that point. Bert Rouse said, "What do we do?" I said, "Jump over this hedge." We jumped the hedge over opposite the school. It was only about 3 foot, and I stood up and I was here. I was above my waist in snow. He said, "Now what do we do?" I said, "Lay flat and roll." Well, it was only about 35, 40 yards to the trees. And we just laid on the top and rolled. And our speed stopped us from sinking in. And we got to the trees, but a machine gunner followed me. Now, if it had gone in front, and they were firing one, all the time they were firing 1 in 5 tracer bullets. So you got a dotted line coming out here. In the trees, you could see them coming for you. But instead of going in front of me, he followed me. The nearest I got, a tracer bullet went through my epaulet and scorched my neck. One tracer. When we got to the tree and had time to gather our wits, I had a Norwegian pack in my blouse. My pack had 13 bullets and only one burnt my neck. A tracer bullet. And Bert Rouse, he had a clip of 5 rifle bullets, 303, in his pocket. He had a groove right through all the 5 and not one had gone off. Otherwise, he'd have blown his head off. And I had 2 bullets in my mess tin. They went through double thickness and I hadn't the strength to get out. All in my pack. And there was us 5 and an officer. All went the same way. And we got the trees. And why I did this, I don't know. Once we got, you know, clear, he said, "Everybody fill your water bottle. Nobody drinks until I tell you." Well, I mean, there's all that damn snow there. You could just get a mouthful of snow. He was talking as though there might be a drought. Anyway, we went to this farmhouse up the hillside and they said, "You look a bit rough." Well, I was about 13 days on no shave because all our kit bags had been blown up with no personal kit. And they said, go and have a wash. They give us 5 raises. Go and have a wash and a shave. We'll cook you a meal. So this was about midday. They cooked us a meal. We went to sit down, and just as we were going to sit down and eat it, the sun came and he said, "Tisca's coming." They'd followed the directions and sent a patrol after us. Took us in the barn and buried us in straw, you know, well deep in the straw. The Germans came again, this patrol, burn it in the straw. They searched the house and then they went. And they fetched us back in again and we sat down and had this meal. And the officer said, "Is there anyone who speaks English around here?" And they said, "Yes, the farm over the hill." So he went and he got map and given a general idea, you know, what direction to take and a rough idea where the Germans were, and he comes back. Well, we didn't like the idea. We'd been about 8 days together and he was coming trying to tell us what to do. But we were no good as a fighting force. It was just every man for himself, try to get home or get to Sweden, you know. So he comes back to the farm. He said, "I've got quite a bit of information. I've got some maps. I've been told what direction, you know, on a rough idea with Germans." I said, "We'll set off at midnight." So he said, "Well, we've been 2 days and we've had no sleep, so we're going to stay up at night." So he said, "Okay, I'll go on my own." He went off, left us 5. He went at 12 o'clock, we went at 1 o'clock. It was then when we got to Punjin City where we met these Norwegian officers. But when we got to Punjin City, we were cooking a meal. Venison, pearl barley and curry. Warm us up. We were stood at the door while it was cooking and we saw this here figure in khaki walking up. Well, could have been a German dressed in khaki, we didn't know. Anyway, we waited and when he got about 20 yards off us, he says, "Something smells nice, can I join you?" So we knew then it was one of ours. Anyway, it was one of the Leicester officers, major of the Leicesters. So he says, "Something smells nice, can I join you?" So we said, "Yeah." Anyway, he had this meal with us, and he said, "How have you been going on like?" So I said, "Well, so far we've done quite well. We've been in a few ambushes, but so far we're doing quite well." So he says, "Well, we'll carry on as we are. You 5 go together, and I'll go my way." Anyway, he finished up. He was camp commandant at Colditz for a while. So he didn't do any better than us myself. Anyway, these officers at the... When we met the Leicester officers, the Norwegian officers at Punjin City, they took us on and we went to that hut, Peer Gynt. We stayed there for a day and a half to get some rest and have a good sleep. And then we set off again. From there, I can't think of what we did. We stayed at another hut beyond Otter, where they lived. I can't think of the place because we were up in the mountains. We were looking down on the valleys and there's no signposts up there. You can only guess later, like, you know, you go through the maps. And anyway, they took us up in the mountains 50 miles beyond Otter. And they was having a conference and we thought, because the skier, the lieutenant who was King Arkong's guide, before we set out in the morning, he used to do about an hour's tour around, find out where the Germans were. We went on the next nearest route. And then every now and again, he used to go out on patrol again and see if there were anything of any danger. Change of course again. And anyway, he'd been out this particular morning before we set off. When he came back, they were having a conference and we knew it was something serious like. So Captain Bergseth, he said, "Lads," he says, "I'm afraid this is about as far as we can go." And they were also 50 miles beyond where they lived. So we set off on our own. Well, we finished up, we were about 3 days and nights just on mountain tops. Nowhere to sleep, no cover, nothing to eat. And about 3 o'clock one morning, we saw 3 huts dotted out. So we went to them. Had we seen pine forest another half a mile further on, we wouldn't have stayed, we would have gone for cover. But say we was tired, we were hungry. We ransacked or searched the 3, got some venison again, pearl barley. We cooked a meal. This was night. We woke up at 11 o'clock. There's a road 200 yards away which we couldn't see in the moonlight. Then we saw the Paris and saw what a mistake we'd made, like, you know, through it being through dark. But after 3 days and nights, you take first thing that comes. And we saw this road 200 yards away. There was Germans piled arms. There must have been a couple hundred at least, filling shell holes on the road 200 yards in front of us. So we thought, oh dear, what do we do now? Just open mountainside. So we thought, well, if we hang about, they'll probably go to the field kitchens dinner time, and just give us that chance to cover the half a mile, get out of the way. But why, I don't know. Someone said, well, if we're going to be another 3 days, why not have a meal while we're waiting for these? What did we do? We lit a fire. Smoke gave us away. The only time in 2 or 3 weeks that we slipped up, we lit a fire.
What happened and, then when you lit the
fire? What happened? Sergeant Davis went out, we had a pair of binoculars. He went out behind a building, he was keeping watch. We were hoping if they did come, when we saw them coming, some of us could hide in the building. But didn't get to that stage. A German officer tapped Davis on the shoulder and said, I wouldn't bother about them, the war is over for you. And we was in the corner, same as over there. The door behind us, I was stirring pearl barley, another chap was doing coffee, and we was cooking this meal. Well, what they'd done, they'd gone right from the flanks and sent Austrian Alpine skiers behind us and closed in on us, and that's how they caught Sergeant Davis outside with the binoculars. Five officers came in the building. Now, we didn't know until someone said, come on, get dressed. I looks round and there's a Luger pistol in my back. I said, that's blown it. Bert says, what's the matter? Germans. And there were five officers stood behind us, three spoke English. And they said, come on, get dressed. So we did. They took us outside onto the road. Well, there was about 30 lifted their rifles, pointed rifles at us. Whether they thought we might try and run for it or not, I don't know. But there, with no cover at all, it was hopeless. And this lieutenant started asking us questions. What ship did you come on? We don't know. What day did you land? We don't know. And what regiment did you belong to? We don't know. Now, earlier on our freedom walk, we met a corporal of the foresters had been in an ambush. They was on a hilltop waiting for transport to Handel's Nest, hopefully, to go to Handel's Nest. There was this here tank came up the road and he saw them nip over the hedge. And they said, it's okay, Englander, you can come out now. Lieutenant Eastham, I think it was, went out to the tank and they shot him in the road in front of the tank. Captain Lieutenant McConnell, another officer, medical officer, went out to help him. They shot him. Then they strafed the wood while they thought there was no one to tell tales. Now, this corporal got away and he gave us a German Tommy gun that we carried around with us. And he said, keep a bullet apiece, they're not taking prisoners. Well, after what he saw, it was, you know, it was fact. They shot all that group. At least they thought that. He got away. How many more? I don't know. So we thought when we got captured there that they would shoot us anyway. So we weren't going to tell them anything. So we thought, well, they're going to shoot us anyway, so they'll shoot us not knowing anything. But anyway, he got a bit aggravated. He said, if you don't tell me, he said, I'll shoot you. And then, so I say, there were about 30 of the rifles pointed at us. And he said, I'll ask you once more. And he said, if you don't tell me, that's it. Anyway, he was asking us, and a big staff car pulled up, gold braids, red and gold braids. It was Austrian Alpine officer, major, Austrian Alpines. Now, we didn't know any German, but he got talking to this German lieutenant. After a while, the talk got to an argument, and the Austrian Alpine major pulled his Luger out on the German lieutenant. So that makes us wonder whether we should have survived it. He pulled his revolver on the lieutenant, and after a while, he sent us back to there, to Dumbos, which was that hotel, which was their brigade headquarters. Austrian Alpine headquarters. But we went with Austrians only, no Germans. after we when we got this hotel, we was loading stores. What the no, what they captured stores, ours, Norwegians, onto lorries, and we were serving in the dining hall, you know, and we were having the same meal as they had. When they finished, we got what was left. And they looked after us quite well, these Austrians. No aggravation at all. They were quite nice chaps. Anyway, the second day, I said to the major, I said, I've got some Norwegian money. Can I go to your canteen and buy some Norwegian chocolate? He said, yes. I went to the canteen, taps on the window, and it was this same German lieutenant. I said, can I have some chocolate, please, like, you know. He says, not for you English pigs, you know, and he wouldn't serve me. So that still makes me think, you know, that's as far as we would have got if it hadn't been for this major. Anyway, I went back to him, I said, he won't serve me, so he said, I have some chocolate, you have my chocolate, and give me your money and I'll buy some when I have time. And he said, where did you come from? I said, Tretton. He said, I fought at Tretton. He said, you chaps put up a damn good show at Tretton. He said, but how did you get from Tretton here? We said, ammo boots. We walked all the way. He said, it's impossible. So we thought we hadn't done so bad. If he thought it was impossible, we thought we'd, you know, put up a good show. Anyway, from there they sent us to, after about 4 days, they sent us to Oslo. Because there were two or three more chaps coming, there were too many to hang on to. They sent us to Oslo, and we was in what we thought was either jail or naval barracks. And they kept us there for 5 days. They took us for exercise in a little orchard where we could see them loading and unloading ships, you know, quite close to the quayside. And while we were there, they said, you can broadcast home, no propaganda. You could broadcast, tell your parents you're well or we're wounded but we're okay, you know, or whatever, but no propaganda. Well, about half of the chaps had broadcast, then the one or two silly fools started, you know, running Germans down, so that was it. I never got the chance.
When you were kept then, at Donbass by the Austrians, what, yeah, did they keep a close guard on you, or were you more or less free to wander about?
We were free to wander about around the hotel area, and where, you know, we were loading supplies, what they captured, onto lorries and that. No, we walked quite freely, but I don't think we would have managed to escape from it, because it was too far for cover, you see, waiting to see by the hotel.
What did they do with you at night then?
If the forest had been quite close by, then there's that chance. They might have got away. But
what did they do with you at night time?
We slept in the ballroom below ground floor.
Were you locked up or guarded at night?
I don't remember a guard on the door. We was in this room where they locked the door. I can't even remember now where they locked the door. I won't be certain about that. But we was below ground level in the ballroom. We would have had to have gone through their quarters and had to get out, you know.
You're mentioning,
I suppose, I don't know, we didn't think about it at the time.
You're mentioning the German being unpleasant.
Yeah.
Was there were all the Germans like that? Did they all show hostility and dislike?
Not at Donbass, because, as I say, it was Austrian Alpine headquarters, and they were quite reasonable. Quite decent chaps. And the chaps that took us from the lieutenant down to Donbass, they were trying all the way down to Donbass to gun first, you know, as well as they could. No, they were quite friendly. Had they been Germans, I don't know, but these Austrians, they were quite friendly, and they wanted to converse with us, like, you know, and it was more or less sign language at the time, you know, but we seemed to get through to one another.
But so you didn't meet any other Germans then, other than those who'd caught you in the huts?
No, not then, no. Because, as I say, at Donbass there was mainly Austrian Alpines.
What about the...
No, the cornflower in the cap.
What about the people who took you down to Oslo? Who were they?
Well, we went so far on a German lorry. Went to, I said, two-thirds of the way on lorry, and then they put us onto a bus. Then we went by a bus. But they were quite decent chaps, too. Whenever, you know, there was no aggro between us.
So apart from this one lieutenant, there wasn't any
apart
real
unpleasantness? Apart from lieutenant, when it right now. And then, as I say, when we got down to the prisoner, whatever, in Oslo, after some of the chaps made a fool of broadcasting, spoiled it for us that were left, we never got the chance, they came round with sheets of foolscap. But it was only information seeking. You can write to your parents if you play football, tell them to send you footballs and this, that and other. And they said, there won't be censored, so it doesn't matter. You can tell them what day you landed or what ship you come on and all this rigmarole, you know. And we knew what was happening. We knew they would never get no further than Oslo, these letters. They were just trying to get information. So when they found out there was nothing for them on this sheets of foolscap, you know, we just wrote straightforward letters home, not mentioning the war at all. Like, you know, we just said we were prisoners and we was fit or whatever, and, you know, or we might be wounded, but we're okay, that sort of thing. But there were no mention of what happened or how we got there. So I thought, well, we'll have to try some other way. And what they did, we had to go to a room and be interviewed. But I came to you to be interviewed. Like, I left that room. I finished up. When I left you, I went in another room. You weren't allowed to go back to the room where you'd left your mates.
You kept isolated
then?
We
kept isolated, so we couldn't tell them what was going off. So you went in the room. He was a young chap, I should say, about 24. And he spoke good English, but he started off, you know, what were you in Civis Street? You know, what sort of a job did you do? And, oh, I was in the building trade. Oh, you'll be able to work at your train in Germany. And he built a beautiful picture up in the camps. You know, it was going to be like, we were going to holiday camps, the way he was talking. And then he'd tell me about his family, you know, he'd got a couple of sisters or whatever. And he was going through his family. And then he said, what day did you say you landed? I didn't say. And he'd gone a bit further and he said, oh, you landed on such and such a ship, didn't you? I said, no, I didn't say so. And he would carry on like that, keep bringing something in as he was going on. And when he went in the room, he was laughing and smiling and shaking hands. He was nearly getting the boot when he went through the door. Didn't get to know what he was. He couldn't get through the door quick enough, so that was a waste of time.
What sort of state of mind were you in at this stage then, when you'd just been captured, or recently been captured?
Well, at that time, I got no fears at all. Because something that happened in my life from being first going to school, I knew I was going to Poland, so I knew I was going to survive Norway. I don't know if it interests you at all, if I'll tell you. So when I was a young lad at school, you're about 8 years old before you understand what you're reading, you know, a little bit of what you're reading. Now, up to 1920, Poland had never been in. Poland was 150 years, and it was ruled by Austria, Prussia. It was never a country for 150 years up to 1920. As I say, when I went to school, I was about 8 years old. Teacher was marking lessons, and they said, okay, silent reading. It was geography, silent reading. Well, I looked through this here, and instead of looking for British Empire, to read about the British Empire, I saw a piece, Poland, the Land of the Rainbow. Now, whether Poland, the Land of the Rainbow fascinated me, not the title, or what, I don't know. But from then onwards, I'd got Poland on my mind. And every time it was silent reading, I was reading about Poland, the Land of the Rainbow. And I was reading over and over again. And British Empire didn't mean a thing. I was interested in Poland. When I was 10 years old, I was going to school with a pal. I heard a word, Posen. And I thought he'd said Posen to me. It was that clear, Posen. And I thought Tom had said Posen. I said, why did you say Posen to me? He said, I didn't. But it was as though it was spoken. And I thought, you know, what's it trying to tell me? Now, this word Posen came up a few times. And I was 12 years old. We bought a wireless, a Franti wireless. It said Posen Military, Posen Civil, 2 radio stations. So then I knew Posen was a town. But I still couldn't understand what it was trying to tell me. At the beginning of the war, We was in Newark waiting for the 11 o'clock news to say whether there was going to be a war or not. But during that time we were waiting, there was a war bulletin. It said the Poles were fighting the Germans in the Polish corridor near Posen. And I thought, I'm going to go to Poland to fight the Germans in Poland. So when I got to Norway, I said to my captain, I shall leave Norway. I won't get killed in Norway. I said, I might get wounded, but I will survive Norway. And he said, why? And I told him, he said, you're crazy. I said, okay, I'm crazy.
What about the other men who'd been captured with you? How did they feel at that time when they'd been caught? Were they depressed by it?
No, I don't think so. I don't think we had time to think about it, you know. I don't think it had really sunk in.
So you're still in a state of shock, then?
No, I seemed quite happy. I knew in my mind I'd further to go. And it was funny because when we left there, when we left Oslo, we went to Hamburg down the Kiel Canal. We stayed at Hamburg on the boat. That night we got there at 4 o'clock. It's an international port, everybody speaks English or German or French. It's an international port, everybody knows a different language. And they wanted to try their English out on us. Everybody was friendly. If they'd got near enough, they'd been shaking hands. Now, that night, 11 o'clock, the RF bombed it for the first time. And they had quite a bit of damage. Our ship was lifted out of the water, and that was as far as, you know, that was the worst we got on the swell from a bomb. But there was a cruiser, and I saw three on the deck of this cruiser. Right mess. But the next morning, them same people that was more or less shaking hands, you know, asking us how we were and where we lived, all this carry on. They were spitting and throwing stones at us. The same people as been quite friendly that before. And when we left Hamburg, we could leave only with the curtains drawn. They wouldn't let us see the bombing and gloat over what we'd done. So, until we left Posen, until we left Hamburg, we couldn't have curtains drawn, see where we were going. And we carried on to Berlin. When we got to Berlin, they took us off the train, took us on a 2-hour propaganda march down onto Den Linden and down the main thoroughfare with loudspeaker vans behind us. And then they brought us back. I guess on the train, and guess where we go? My first three prison camps, Napoleonic Fort, Posen in Poland. And that's followed me all the way, Posen. Now, I got work, when I was there, I was working in a German cookhouse, 10 of us. I was friendly with a Polish girl, but only after I got friendly with the two Germans in charge, because they would have taken reprisals, like, you know, against her. So she used to bring me food, buy me bottles of German beer out of their canteen. Now, her father had been a prisoner with the British in 1418 war, could speak English, so what we couldn't say to one another, he used to translate our letters. Now, he gave her two books for me to read, and they were written in English. One was Russian Revolution, Yudinev's Russia. Guess what the other one was? Poland, the land of the rainbow. From 8 years old. You know, it just takes some understanding. But when we got to Posen, they didn't do what we did in Berlin, take us all down the street. They took us to our first camp,